This is Jeremy Park, CEO of CityCurrent, personally inviting you to Growth Current. Growth Current is our e-learning and online personal development platform with CityCurrent. It's an opportunity to attend virtual events with global thought leaders, national guest speakers, and experts who can help you grow personally and professionally. It gives you access to success secrets, lessons learned, learning modules, and so much more. Subscriptions are only $8 a month, and you can do bulk subscriptions for your team. Check out growthcurrent.co to learn more.
Welcome to the Changemakers Podcast, produced by CityCurrent and brought to you by Lipscomb and Pitts Insurance. This show shares personal stories and insight from those who are giving back and making a difference so we can learn and do the same. We cover life lessons, business advice, passion, and purpose. Now here's our host, the CEO of CityCurrent, Jeremy Park.
Welcome to the Changemakers Podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Park. We've got some fun talking about entrepreneurialism, starting a clothing company, farming, meditation, travel. You're in for a treat. We have Joel Primus. He's a father, a husband, an entrepreneur, and we're going to dive into his story. So Joel, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Doing well. So you are in Canada. So this becomes a global podcast on this range, but the fun of Changemakers is we get to know you personally, a lot of your story, as well as obviously the business lessons learned. So let's start out with you. Talk about where you grew up and especially being a long distance runner.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on the podcast. And it's great to share this story with all your listeners. I am like not that far from where I actually grew up in small town, rural Canada. And I had a kind of an interesting journey back here. Because I grew up with, you know, when one of those towns that was a true suburban town. You could play hockey, street hockey on the streets. You could, like, there was a creek with a forest that felt like it went on forever right behind your house, but you could still hear your parents call you for dinner, even though you felt like you were gone. And then I started my company in that town. So I grew up there and then eventually ended up moving to Vancouver and then eventually ended up moving to New York City. But after I sold my company, there was this sort of calling to go back. And going back to where I grew up just didn't quite feel right because it had changed so much over time. It had grown so much. And you drive around the town and nobody's playing hockey. And I had two girls and I said, you know, what is the most important thing for them? And that was freedom. That was the ability to be close to nature. And I had used rewilding, I guess you could say, as a way to kind of soothe my soul after a 10-year entrepreneurial journey that had incredible highs and incredible lows. And I was sort of a broken mess at the end of it. And so my cousin, this is getting way off kilter here, but my cousin, he had called me up randomly and he lives like 10 hours north of me, like true Canadian north, okay? And he's like, I want you to come to our cabin in the middle of nowhere. Like, you have to take snowmobiles in and then you have to snowshoe and you already drove 4 hours on a logging road and then, so you're at this cabin. And over the course of these 4 days, I reconnected with like everything quieted. And that was the first time I'd been quiet in years. And it reminded me of the days of running, and we can talk a little bit about that. And I just knew in that moment, because I was still living in the city, I had to get back for myself and for my family. And so now I'm on a farm about 90 minutes outside of Vancouver, just completely rural. You'll hear my chickens probably a couple times in the podcast, up against incredible mountains. And it's a big change. I'm only a few months into this change. And adapting. So that's where I am now. And that's how I ended up here.
So talk about growing up, because this will lead us into the entrepreneurialism side, but talk about growing up and being a runner and really not just being a runner, but a world-class runner.
Yeah. I think the world-class piece, there's a few Kenyans who might disagree with my world-classness, but I did qualify for a couple of world championships. So if you participate, I think that counts.
It does.
running's interesting because it became the lens of which I shaped a lot of my entrepreneurial philosophy going forward, because it's a very lonely pursuit. You're not on a team. There's no camaraderie, really. There's, you know, there's some, but you're out there and you're running for hours, sometimes alone in the forest with your thoughts and only yourself to push you. You're tired. You have to make that choice whether to go in a and whether that's a race or training. You have to make that choice to wake up on mornings where it's dark, it's cold, it's pissing with rain, and you have to. No one's there to put their hand on your back and say, get out there and run, right? Except for that voice inside of you that says, this is going to make you a little bit better. This is going to give you one more inch, one more second, right? And so, it was a two-edged sword growing up with that. But I realized that I was half decent at it pretty early on, and that my 5'5" at the time stature was not going to get me into the NBA. So I dropped every other sport and I went completely and utterly into running. And that led me, that gave me the gift of, you know, those lessons I just talked about, but it gave me the gift of getting able to travel a little bit, getting a scholarship to a university. It opened doors to being an ambassador with the Olympics in Vancouver. And so it kind of paved the way into these other worlds that I had no idea it was going to do. But what ended up happening was, and this was sort of the first hard life lesson I really ever learned, and sort of the first death of me, if you will, is that I had this full ride scholarship. I was down in North Carolina. I just qualified for the World Cross Country Championships. And then I ruptured my Achilles. Snap. And as the story goes, that's a 18-month journey before I was actually fully out of running. But that break set me on a new course. And what the challenge was for me was that I was so self-identified as a runner, and I was so entrenched in the belief that the only thing for me was success as a runner, success as an Olympian. It sounds kind of esoteric and silly, but I literally didn't know who I was when that ended. And I had to go find myself. And that led to hitchhiking across Canada, getting on a plane to Thailand, which inspired me to, you know, showed me I didn't really know the world at all. And so it led to all these different things. But that was a tough journey, because when you're not comfortable in who you are, and then because like that thing that you self-identified with was taken away, sometimes what fills that void is not good. And that's why I always say that the start of my first business, or well, actually my third, but the only one, first real one, was rooted in both a really great drive to do something and see what I could do in the world, and also a deep-seated fear that if I didn't do something, I wasn't worth anything, because I'd lost that running piece. So I had to then deal with that as I started my business and shed all the negative reasons of which I'd done it, that I didn't know for years later, right? Until you start to see pieces of your life chip away, family relationships, different things like that, because you're so self-absorbed in this, again, this secondary singular identity that I'd formed. So. Yeah.
Well, the funny thing is, and it's not funny, it's more of just reality, is that I can totally relate. Because, I mean, as you're telling the story, I'm thinking mine was tennis, and then I blew my shoulder out. And it was the same thing of it comes crashing down. And so everything you put your heart and soul into is the future you were trying to build literally comes crashing down out of your control, and you have to pivot and refine yourself and calibrate. Talk about, you know, ultimately what leads you on this journey to start this clothing company, Naked, because part of it is kind of serendipity in some ways coming together on finding the cotton and climbing a mountain. And so share the story of what comes and brings all these pieces together.
You know, I always love how it works, because it's not just my story. So many entrepreneurs, when you hear their story, it was like there was this moment where something literally just presented itself to you. And then you had this feeling. It's almost, I think Brené Brown think it's her who says that, like, the ideas kind of float around and then they land on people. And then if you don't want it, if you're not ready to act, then it lifts itself up and starts floating around. Whether or not that's true, it certainly feels that way when you're in that moment, because it's a visceral experience. And so I had, after Thailand and Cambodia and Southeast Asia and England sort of thing, I was like, okay, I want to make a film about how travel is so important as a part of shaping us to be citizens of the world. And so I got home from that trip. I started working two jobs. I was a bartender, I was a landscaper, and I was trying to raise funds for this film. And I said, like, the total amount of sponsorship I got was nil. So it was like all our own cash. And we ended up going from Mexico down to Santiago, Chile. Now the film story fell apart in that moment. We'll come back to it later. But what happened was I needed some underwear in Peru. I've been traveling, backpacking. I had all this terrible underwear from like grade 11 still or whatever, right? And so I go to this night market and there's this gorgeous Pima cotton. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is way better than anything my mother has ever bought me. And I don't know why, but I'm just going to buy a whole bunch. And so I throw a whole bunch in my backpack. And then, you know, a week or two later, I end up hiking at Machu Picchu and the cotton starts chafing. And I'm like, well, it felt really good, but then it didn't perform really good. And so I started to think about the running fabrics I had used for my whole career. And I said, how can I kind of put these together and create this whole new standard of underwear for men? At that moment in time, having no idea whether or not competitors existed in the market. And I kind of sat on the idea before I fully took the leap for, I want to say, 6 months, and just kind of kept chewing on it and chewing on it. And then I had a friend's grandma, you know, like, who do we know that knows how to sew?
Right. I need a sample. Nobody
within two generations of us. So our friend's grandma, she ends up like sewing 7 pairs of like this idea for the underwear in her basement. And they're like, they're literally atrocious. But then, so there's no business plan. There's no nothing, but there's this underwear. And we get invited to go into a fashion show in Abbotsford, in like religious small town Abbotsford. And I'm like, okay, we'll take that opportunity. And so we took these 7 pairs that were made by a grandma of underwear, went on this show, and like kind of a goofy, ridiculous little hit. And people are like, where can I buy it? And I'm like, I literally, these are the 7 pairs. And they, so long story short, like that was a leap moment in many regards to, okay, let's try this. Let's see where she goes.
Well, it goes pretty far. I mean, all the way to Dwayne Wade and Spider-Man. And so, you know, carry that forward on just building this business and some of your favorite highlights for it.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's the favorite highlights, of course. Yeah. Like sitting courtside at a Miami Heat game, you know, ringing the NASDAQ bell, like those types of things are so cool and they're so special. And they're so far from anything I'm doing right now. So that's like, I look back on them very fondly. But the real special moments were, you know, we had this small team, all like, you know, everyone's paid minimum wage type, but they're just all in, right? They're all in. And we have this terrible warehouse and it's freezing cold because we can't afford the heating for it. And we got underwear piled up. And I would travel and then we'd go to the different stores and we'd get these orders. And then we'd come back and we'd have these packing parties. And like, whether it was just our small team or whether it was some friends and family, we'd like order pizza and we play music and we pack these orders. And I don't think ever, or there's many times in my life where something just felt so good in its purity and its ignorance and it's just like unbounding belief, untouched by the realities that I was about to face coming down the line. And so honestly, those meetings or those moments in those early days with our little team, those are the ones that meant the most. And of course, it grew, like you said, like we got Nordstrom's. We're like 90 minutes from Seattle. So I used to just drive down to Seattle and like impromptu pop into the Nordstrom's office, leave underwear, beg for a meeting until they finally did. And so we got now Nordstrom's, we got Bloomingdale's, and then Spider-Man wore it. It ended up kind of growing. We could talk about the go public thing. That was crazy. You know, and then what ended up happening was I started to feel as a founder CEO way over my head. And I started to have fears that, because I had a lot of shareholders, we'd raised millions of dollars, that for better or worse, I needed to put somebody else in. And I found somebody in New York who was incredible. She'd had $150 million business in the space. She'd sold it. She was free to dedicate, like the perfect storm, right? And I brought her on and moved my family to New York. We had people from Armani and Brooks Brothers, and that imposter syndrome actually kind of grew even bigger in me. I'm like, what the heck do I contribute to this thing anymore, right? Not realizing at that moment just how important founders are to their companies. And so long story short, after moving to New York, the business grew more. And then we got this surprise knock on the door from an Australian lingerie company that wanted to effectively buy us. Now, this time we're on the NASDAQ, you know, we're doing just okay. Like we're, you know, you're in this situation where you have two businesses. You have the business of being public and the business of growing your business. And that's too much for a startup to handle, unless that startup is capitalized beyond belief. And even then it's probably a waste of funds. But we can get into the merits of some companies going public early or not, or, you know, at what stage. But so we ended up selling the company almost as soon as we moved to New York. It was like year two in New York. So I'd only been there a year. We'd begun the process of this merger, which took another 18 months.
Yeah.
And then I was out of it. And it was, yeah, it was a really tough experience. And I talk a lot about, I had depression, I had anxiety. I was not my best self in any single relationship I had. And I was just trying to do all these things and I was sort of failing at all of it. And so part of the reason for writing the book and now just now becoming a coach is there's just so many blind spots on your first startup. And there's some ones that are just very practical that have to do with business and just the business of being a startup. And there's a lot in here that we carry that we're not aware of.
Yeah.
And I wasn't aware of them.
I'm curious, you know, in this moment, what's one thing looking back? Because obviously you can't change the past. You don't have the regrets on that side. But what's one thing that in that moment you wish you would have seen, or a bit of advice you wish you would have had? Like what's something looking back like that you wish you would have known?
Yeah. Gosh. I mean, there's a lot. Yeah. There's a lot. What's the one thing?
What's one thing in general? Because there's not just one thing, but what's one thing?
No, that's super fair. I think the answer would have been go slower. Like, go slower, my son, because rushing, you know, I was deluded by, you read all these overnight billionaires in the tech space and you read about all the best, right? And so you have this desire, especially as a competitive athlete in my DNA, to win.
Mm.
And so instead of slowing down throughout the entire process, especially in New York, the weight of the expectation of going public. And I, like you said, I don't regret it because it was, when you go back, you can, hindsight's 2020, you can always say, oh, I could have done that differently.
Right.
Yeah, like we're all armchair quarterbacks on that, right? But that was the underlying theme of like the mounting anxiety and pressure, was because I wasn't strong enough, disciplined enough, brave enough to say no to a lot of things. And instead I just kept piling as opposed to hyper-focusing and getting wins, small wins. And it's like, no, we're going to do this and we're going to do this.
How old were you in that moment?
Well, that was probably, where I should have been adhering to the lesson a little bit better was like 26, 27. You know, early on, you're just going, you know, when you're 22, 23, starting, you're just going. But by the time I'd been through a few, you know, the lessons, they keep coming and keep the same ones. Oh, you didn't learn it, you idiot. You know, let's do it again. You know, like, let's do it again. And that gets expensive for a startup, you know, and it gets painful in real life.
But I think what you're talking about, I mean, is so easy to understand in terms of getting in over your head, where it's like, you know, you launch this company and all of a sudden you're working your tail off, but yet all of a sudden the expectations and the pressure continues to build, and you find yourself in rooms with people who this is their whole life. And you're like, wait a second, I'm just kind of in this space and I'm learning as I go. And what do I do? And I can easily see where that would, both the imposter syndrome, but also too, just beat you down on your confidence. And especially in a city like New York, where not only is it in your DNA to want to win, you're also in a city that moves at light speed, where you're trying to keep up with the Joneses and everything is expensive and in your face. And so it's like, that accelerates it even more, which I think is very different than the life you're living now, which just by nature of the environment you're in tends to calm and slow it down.
Yes, absolutely. I always wonder about that. I feel like the people born in New York, it's just in their blood.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't see, like, nobody in New York seemed overly stressed about the frantic pace of which they lived their life, except me, right? Which is why I've never earned the title New Yorker, no matter how, you know, the few years I was there. But the thing that's the hardest thing to do in our whole life is just be authentic to ourselves, because we're always at the mercy of the news, the celebrities, then the confidants and the mentors and everybody in this circle who's got an opinion, to just hold on to yours. You know, the shame that I felt coming here, it was like, it was sickening, because it was sort of against the grain of everything that, you know, I was doing to like come to a place where you can't just go to a meeting on a fly and different things like that. But they say, I think everyone knows this expression, it's like, people don't change unless the prospect of not changing is far worse. And so I had three series of illnesses. Like, I ended up in hospital on IV from just so much stress. And that was twice. And the first time, why my wife came. And the second time, she said, that's on you. Like, you did that to yourself. You should have learned the lesson the first time. And then it was a few months later that one of my dear friends, who was an investor in the company and was only 2 years older than me, he died. He died of a heart condition. And he had two young girls, my girl's age. And then the next morning, I remember somebody telling me, like, this is life, you go on. And so the next morning after I found out he died, I was on a plane to San Antonio for a business trip. And I literally just, like, I muscled my way through that day. You know, I did two Nordstrom's, or one Nordstrom's, one Dillard's store. I did three investors, an investor luncheon, an investor breakfast, and an investor dinner. I got home to my hotel and I literally just broke down. And I was like, something has to change. Something has to change. I could be my friend. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big moment for me.
But I think, you know, what you're talking about is the hard So there's always the darkness and the light. There's always the challenge and the glitz and glamour, right? And what you're talking about is the very hard reality of being an entrepreneur. Yes. And when you talk about the time, the dedication, the sacrifice, but the mental pressure and angst and anguish that you're under versus what you see on, you know, to your point in the papers and, you know, in the news of the kind of the sexy glitz and glamorous side, the entrepreneurial, you know, out there making the millions of dollars and whatever else. But what you realize, to your point, is that is not always one, the truth of what you see like on Instagram. That's not always the reality, right? That's the painted picture that you want everybody to see.
Yeah.
So you don't see behind the veil, but at the same time, that's not for everyone. That's not what your bliss is. That's not what makes you happy. And so it might be in that moment, but ultimately you get to that point and you realize, it doesn't make me happy. You know what? Like, I want family. I want this. I don't want to die at an early age because I'm putting myself under so much pressure. It's not worth it. I have the story now, and now let's go create a new narrative. And that's actually what you're doing with your family. And so, you know, talk about what you're doing now, because you are engaging your family in travel. You are bringing them in so you grow together and learn together and farm together and do all these things. But now you're really immersed in this. And obviously that carries into the book and the film and everything else too.
Yeah, the realization that hit me was that sort of morphed over time into, how do I hold on to my kids? There was like this understanding that we can explain that, but understanding that I believe when I say holding on to the kids, I mean holding the space. I don't mean being overbearing. I don't mean monitoring everything they do so that they don't cultivate their independence. I mean, as a father, holding the space, being the walls that they get to crash against so that they can learn their bads and their goods and their sadnesses and their angers in a safe environment. And by no means do I do that well all the time, but holding that space for them. And I was like, I can't hold that space if I'm not there, physically there. And so everything shifted. Was beginning to shift when I talked about the CAM thing, but then I'd heard this statistic, something to the effect of like, a huge percentage of your time with your kids is lifetime time with your kids is done between birth and 18. It's like ridiculous. I don't want to be quoted saying 70%, if that's not accurate, but it's something ridiculously high. And I'm like, that's 10 years. And I can start as many crazy businesses as I want, if I want, after those 10 years. Right. So I went back to, you know, we decided to homeschool. We decided to, so I do, when I'm not tied up, I do 2 to 3 mornings a week with the girls, just sort of 8 to 10. And then my wife, she handles the brunt of it. And we decided to do this film about the importance of traveling with children, which was the playoff of the one that didn't work 12 years ago, just kind of reinventing itself. And the idea was, again, just time with family, adventures with family, challenges with family to build you closer as a unit. And so that they can see some of these things and develop this and cultivate this, maybe unbeknownst to them, but this subconscious awareness of the global community. Right. And it, because they're going to grow up in a world, unless something changes now, that is, as we've all seen the social dilemma, it's literally we're getting fed the side that we want to learn. And then we just, that's it. And then there's division and there's these nationalist movements, and none of it is cultivating the togetherness that we need. And so that's the idea. To be determined if it works out.
Well, but I think, you know, when you talk about travel, and especially just in general of creating shared experiences, one is it gives you those bonds with your family. Like you're talking about, it gives you time together because you're forced into, you know, this time together to go on this journey. At the same time, though, you're learning together. They get to see that you don't know everything as dad, that you can figure it out. Same thing with mom. So they get to see how you operate. They also get to meet all these different people and see that not everyone has as much or as little, that people have different backgrounds and skin colors and faiths. And it's all a learning opportunity for all of us to be accepting of each other and to have empathy for each other. But all of that builds, to your point, a global perspective, but it also builds really precious time that they will look back on in their life that you can't, to your point, you can't get that back. And so, and I think you brought up a great point. Once you've reached the top of the mountain, one, you know, it's possible to get back there, but two is you realize, yeah, I can do it again. You know what? Let's hit the pause button. Let's focus on family. And if I want that again, I'm better prepared, but I can get back to the top. Now I want to go on this journey and do it with all of these lessons that I've learned and instill them with my children. So what's been one of your favorite moments already with your children, with your family?
The moments that are always the best are when we first arrive in a city. Specifically, you know, we talk about the film, but just in general, you've kind of come blurry-eyed off this red eye, probably, and you're exhausted, but there's this invigorating energy that I think comes from both the motion and just the change in stimulus from the status quo. And you can even see it in the children who are just as jet-lagged. And so maybe it's at night we get in and or in the morning and it's that first meal, whether it's pho for breakfast in Vietnam or it's a spread of mesa in Lebanon. And then you're, you know, generally in those cases, if with relates to the film, somebody from the local community who was helping us with the project would be there and maybe they bring their friend, their husband, their kids. And all of a sudden you're just in this new world. And it just makes you feel a part of something so much bigger. And for them, I felt very grateful that I could even provide that opportunity because I know that that's not something everybody can do. And we sacrificed a lot to make that happen. It wasn't like I had the money to make a film just burning a hole in my pocket. But that's not really the point. The point is just that I could do that for them and that I could see at least a little bit in their eyes that, and then the way that they talked and then the way that they kind of tasted these new foods and kind of had this experience that it's marking their soul in some way. And so those first days and then sometimes the last days when you had to say goodbye. And there's always breaking bread with somebody in the local culture. And it was free of the video camera and any expectations, you know, free of my producer hat at the time. And
yeah.
So those were them for sure.
What's one bit of advice you would give other parents who want to take their children on an international trip? So what's something you've learned that you would encourage other parents to do or not do?
Yeah. I mean, the first one is go, because when you look, again, I understand that this is a privilege. Travel is a privilege, but it is a privilege that has become increasingly more accessible. And a lot of people in North America do have vacation budgets, and that vacation budget is usually pretty similar to what you could do a third world trip, you know, maybe not Paris, but Thailand or Vietnam, where you can have cheaper accommodations, etc. So my advice is always to trade one vacation, trade one Disneyland trip. You've probably been, if you haven't, go. It's kids love it. My kids prefer Disneyland to every other place they've been. They tell me that all the time. But trade one. Pick a spot that's going to challenge you. Pick a spot that intrigues you, but it's going to challenge you. It's not set out. And when you get there, only pick a few things to do. Don't map out an itinerary, because part of the adventure and part of the education and self-empowerment is figuring it out. Showing your kid, plopping your kid, especially if they're a bit older. Mine were young, but like if they're in their young teens and they have to go with dad or mom to haggle a trip, a bus trip or a train trip up north on price and pick a destination, they're going to uncover their own confidence. They're going to see what they can do in the real world. And as a family, yeah, it will. There'll be parts that suck. Our kids cried. At day three of every trip was like the worst jet lag, tears all day, anger, and then it would take like 2 days to finally get over it. And so you have to go through that, right? But again, like you connect through all these things. So that's my advice. Pick a destination that intrigues you, but will challenge you, and don't plan everything. Go with an open book and see where most of that journey takes you. Cause that's what's exciting.
So speaking of journey, talk about the travel on your side, the travel company, and that you've recently launched. And then also too, the book that's coming out, and you got pre-sale and then it comes out officially in January. So talk about those two.
Yeah, that's, the book is a 10-year project. I literally started writing the book about entrepreneurship as told through the story of Naked the day I started Naked. But then it was just like journals and notes. I kind of knew I wanted to write a book, but at that point there was nothing to write about, right? And so, God, it's 12 years now. 12 years later, this book has finally been finished. And the whole idea of the book is I wanted to provide the blueprint, not necessarily the blueprint, but those things that I missed, the questions I didn't ask myself, because we always need to ask ourselves the right questions. The things I didn't foresee when talking to investors or different things like that. It's a book of kind of guideposts at woven in through my story of my failures, because ultimately Naked is not a true success story. It has successes baked into it, but ultimately, the company that acquired us, the stock has performed well, and I would never want to disguise this as like I created Facebook, but all the lessons and experiences are exactly the same, regardless of the outcome. And the message of the book at the end of it, the whole idea behind this title of Getting Naked, is through that whole journey of mistakes and failures is getting back to your true authentic self, understanding how to do that, cultivating balance in your life, and then doing it all over again as an entrepreneur. It's not one and done, which was, again, the mistake I thought, oh, well, this is Naked fails, I'm done. Running fails, I'm done. Life is a journey of being defeated over and over and over again. And we get stronger because we were defeated, no different than our muscles break down to become stronger when we work out and different things like that. So I guess that segues into Kosan, where, we got 10 years of gray hair and whatever else, blood, sweat, and tears in the apparel business. How do I not at least try it one more time? And I wanted to do something in the vein of travel, because I wanted to do something that I was prepared to do the rest of my life. So any business that I got to travel the world and talk about travel and be close to it was like, that's the business I'm going to do. Of course, COVID then hit, which was an interesting challenge that, we're navigating. And as a travel brand, without trying to alienate our core, we don't want to just, oh, COVID's here, pivot the brand. Which those are, more lessons baked into that. But what COVID taught me, again, was nothing's predictable. We had just had $1 million Kickstarter, a 30-day $1 million Kickstarter, and then COVID hit. So there's no sure thing. You have to constantly adapt. And the thing that I'm finally learning to become comfortable with is that adaptation, being comfortable, being uncomfortable, as the saying goes. So we make travel clothing and it's really awesome. And that business is there, and we're monitoring the global conditions as we determine how much to invest in the company right now, how much to raise, how much to push against a very obvious global headwind. So, again, just figuring it out.
The good news is, to your point, is that and even on social media, you're doing a good job of talking about the countries that are open and the adventures you can take again, and kind of pushing it from a global travel just enthusiast and push. And so the point is that we know things will return and the opportunity is there. It's just a matter of the timing. But once again, just saying, hey, when the timing is right, we want to be able and be prepared to take advantage of it, prepared and ready. And so like any entrepreneur, it's always the changing winds and at least being mindful of them and saying, to get to the other side, we've got to be able to move our sail to catch the wind. And we just continue to do that because the winds keep changing. And that's just part of the game.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What's one bit of advice on your end, just as you look at everything that we've talked about, and we'll shift over and do kind of a lightning round where it's short questions, short answers, but what's just one kind of last, either a favorite quote that sticks out or a favorite bit of advice that maybe somebody's given you that when you talk about finding your purpose, staying true to your purpose, navigating all the uncertainty and just the head trash that comes about, you know, as part of this, what's something that grounds you or keeps you grounded that you would encourage for others?
Right. That's a good question. I can't remember, you know, quotes kind of flow in and out of my head. I can't remember who this is, but it's, he who jumps into the void owns no explanation to those who stand and watch. And I take that in many ways, whether you're starting a business, you're jumping into this void where nobody is going to understand except your fellow entrepreneurs just what that means. And no matter whether you're Facebook or you're a $50,000 a year startup, $50,000 in revenue, the feelings are the same. The void is the same. It's a shared experience, and there's a brotherhood and a sisterhood and a community around that. But more than that, more than an entrepreneur, it's the void of uncovering the layers of ourself, because that's the scariest journey. The scariest, that is the true void. When I go into my head and my heart and I ask myself, why am I thinking these thoughts? Why am I telling myself these stories? Where are they coming from? What pain bodies do I have that have told me that have caused me to react this way to certain situations or tell myself these certain things? And to untangle that mess that your parents and society gave you, no fault of their own, they didn't know, but they gave it to you all the same. And you have to untangle that, and you have to uncover who you truly are in this moment. And that is be comfortable being that person is the journey of a lifetime. It's not the journey of 1 month or one ayahuasca session or one counseling session or one, any of that stuff. That is the journey of a lifetime. And we have to do it over and over and over again. And so that's the void. And that's what speaks to me when I think about my own life and I'm like, holy crap, I suck. No, wait, have reverence, have grace, be gentle on yourself. This is the work. And you know, so there's one for you.
I think it's also too the part that separates, you can tell the people who have achieved success, the true entrepreneurs, because they have gone through the darkness. They've gone through the struggle. They understand what pain, like any athlete. Look, if you're an athlete that's never had a loss or felt pain or an injury, I'm sorry, but you probably don't have a lot, you know, in terms of where you've really been, because every athlete at a high level has gone through really painful stuff. Same thing as an entrepreneur. You've gone through, or any business leader, business owner, whatever it is, you've gone through pain and struggle, and as a parent, you will go through pain and struggle. And it's like, that's what makes it where you can connect with others, because you immediately realize really fast. It's like, yeah, we can get through, we can get past the first two layers of the onion, so to speak. And you start getting down and you realize, yeah, we can go and have some real deep conversations because we fought in the trenches together and we understand what it feels like. And if you want to connect with people and you want to be genuine, these are the conversations, because you've gone through the struggle and you've fought through the trenches and you've come out on the other side. And that's what makes it a valuable conversation, but that's also what makes it a fun conversation, is you have something to add and you have value to add now to others because you've been through and you came out and you're still fighting every day. So I think perspective is really important for everybody. Is that darkness gives you a story, but it also too helps you really appreciate the light when it comes, which is a whole nother angle to this. Let's switch over and just do lightning rounds, short questions, short answers, just fun way to wrap up. What do you like to do to relax?
Exercise or drink wine. They balance each other out.
In that order?
Yeah, it's usually, that's my smoothie after.
So are you a red or a white or a champagne, or where do you fall on the spectrum?
I mean, I am a lover of all spirits and wine and beer, but if I had to, the go-to is obviously red. I love it. I find it healing. But on a summer day, white, and if I just want an incredibly relaxing buzz, it's champagne.
So,
yeah.
What's a recent book you've read?
I'm reading, it's right here on my desk, King, Warrior, Magician, Lover. And it's a book about the male archetypes. So King, Warrior, Magician, Lover are the positive archetypes. You just talked about that duality. And then all of those have a shadow self, the tyrant, the coward, et cetera, et cetera. So I've always been fascinated by understanding masculine energy and the dynamic of masculine and feminine energy. And so this book is just providing some framework to that masculine side. And it's really quite scary to see how much of our society suffers today because we do not celebrate, embrace different parts of these archetypes, masculine and feminine. This is a masculine oriented book, but both. So
yeah,
that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah, yeah. So you're one of those, we could have like hour long conversations on so many different things in a good way. Give us one of your favorite vacation spots anywhere around the world.
Vacation spots anywhere around the world. Well, if it is nature, South America offers the spectrum, right? They, from the gorgeous and massive mountains to the Sierra Chicas and the Sierra Grandes, which are a little bit smaller, to the Patagonia, to the desert. It's just, it's a wine country. It is everything. And it's huge. So you need like 6 weeks. I don't think its beaches are fantastic, but they might disagree with me. So for outdoors, definitely Argentina. I mean, Lebanon is fantastic for food. Vietnam, there is no, potentially no more exciting and welcoming city in the world than Ho Chi Minh, Saigon. Like if you just want a burst of humanity in all its chaos, but yet all its beauty and all its what seems like what I mean by that is, it's the most chaotic city in the world, but yet there's this beautiful calm pace that underlies all the chaos. And I think that everyone who goes there would be energized by the food and the people and the pace. So there's a couple.
Yeah. Give me something that you and your wife enjoy doing together. What's something you do together?
So we have what we would call like healing baths at least twice a week, if not three. So we put yarrow root and Epsom salts and magnesium and tea bags and candles, and either we're just in it relaxing, talking, or we are reading to each other. We try and read to each other, take turns. And that sometimes falls in part of what we have, we call, it's from a guy named Brad Feld, and we call it a lifetime date. And so every month on the first, we have a standing date that has probably the bath element, but also just is an open forum. It's not necessarily a romantic date, but it's still supposed to be connecting and unpacking the things that maybe you're building up, stuff like that. So
yeah,
there's nice. A few things.
Yeah, that's good. Who is someone that is a mentor to you? So outside of your parents, maybe, and obviously your wife, but who is someone that's been a great mentor and a big part of your life?
Had many, you know, I wouldn't be anywhere. Being a, what does Will Ferrell say? I'd be face down in a ditch somewhere if it wasn't for the mentors. The one who outside of my parents, obviously, is a gentleman by the name of Jason Gordon, and he's down in Miami, and he has a practice that, I mean, he's an entrepreneur, a businessman, but he's a Buddhist, he's an author, he's a doctor of Chinese medicine. He does jujitsu, everything. And so he just embodies so well all our dualities, the peaceful warrior, the businessman, all these different things. And so many times in my life, I've had to fly down to Miami just to see him and sort of unwind in his place there in Miami Beach. And I'm actually in a men's group that he has right now that's really good that he's leading. He's just, oh my, everything. I owe so much to him, so much to him. It makes me emotional.
Yeah, no, hey, that's why I love this, because it just gives you an open forum to talk through it. And I learn a tremendous amount myself. So what is a quote or a saying or a phrase that inspires you?
I have one sitting on my desk. I'll just read it. Set a goal so big you can't achieve it until you grow into the person who can. And that's really sums up everything that I have gone through and try to teach when I have an opportunity to teach, is that you have to become, and if you think that you have, you maybe haven't yet, right? What is ultimate? And so before it was like, I would post like my running goals, like I want to run this time, they'd be on my ceiling, they'd be written in my track spikes, and they were so literal. And I'd often achieve them, but it wasn't as grand as I think about it now. I think about it as like the totality of my life. And so that's, you know, that keeps me going.
You're obviously creating it, especially with your family right now, and you will continue with the book and everything you're doing, but what do you hope many, many years from now, decades from now, that you hope your legacy is?
I actually write about legacy in the book as a dangerous thing. It's not my idea. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner, and he talked about how legacy projects, the things that we attach our identity to, if you will, become things that take us out of the present moment. They take us out of the life. They become almost selfish. Now, that said, of course, we can have a legacy, and it's not a terrible thing. It just is, it's kind of like memento mori, remember death, just like, remember that this legacy doesn't really mean anything. It totally 100% for me, if we want to go there, comes back to my daughters. And if I, because we are passing on either our wounds or our wisdom to our children, right? And generally both, in equal parts, if not more wounds. So if I can just give them the tools as a legacy to face with courage and grace and gentleness on themselves, all that they're going to face as women, young women, and then, you know, as they grow, and in a world that's really, really challenging. It is not a simple world. And so if I can give them those tools, then I've done everything that I needed to do.
Yeah, I always think when you talk about legacy, it's, I think Dr. Bertice Barry, to me, probably summed it up the best. It's not necessarily what others say when you die. It's what they say about you when you leave the room. So it's the way that you are creating your impact with each and every interaction that you make, and whether that's with your children or with others or with anyone. So it's
and a it lot. Should, it shouldn't be different, right? Like to your point, the way I leave the room with my daughter should be the same way I leave the room with a colleague, with anyone. It should be the same thing. There shouldn't be two versions of myself coming to those parties. And it's hard. I can assure you, my daughter does not always have positive things to say about me when I leave the room. So
you know. I don't think any child would with their parents. So there's always a disagreement of, you know, what the boundaries are, or the rules or whatever else. So that's just life as a parent.
Yeah.
So wrap up and talk about websites and social media. And so with all the different projects that you're involved in, and for you personally, where all do we go to stay in the know?
Yeah, appreciate that. Appreciate the opportunity. So joelprimus.com is my blog. And so I generally write a blog a month, and sometimes business, sometimes fitness, and just sometimes self-development, self-awareness, stuff like that. So that's sort of the center of my universe. And then joel.primus is my Instagram. There's another place where I'm fairly active. I'm a little bit inconsistent, full disclosure, because sometimes I just get pulled. You know, I'm not an influencer, so I don't need to be there daily, but it's all there. And from one of those two places, you can find everything else about, you know, the companies, the projects and different things like that.
Yeah, you make it easy, especially on your website, to find all the different storylines and connect in. So great resource right there. Well, Joel, you are indeed a change maker. This is one of those that, like we said, we could have hour-long discussions on so many different topics. So we'll have to find some other avenues to start pulling you in so that we can share so much more of your wisdom. But thank you for all you do. Thank you for coming on the podcast. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Changemakers Podcast, produced by City Current and brought to you by Lipscomb and Pitts Insurance. To learn more about our guests and share your stories of others leading by example, visit us online at citycurrent.com or follow us on social media using @citycurrent. Please make sure to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast wherever you listen. Now, think big, start small, and act now. Be a changemaker.